Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the historical novelist and journalist Katie Grant speaks with me about how she came to be a writer, the differing roles of novelist and journalist, and the musical journey she took in writing her latest novel. Katie Grant, also known as K.M. Grant for children and young adult fiction and Catherine Grant for adult fiction, was born into a family described by Lord Burghley, treasurer to Elizabeth I, as of more than usual perversity for clinging to their Catholic faith during the Reformation. She grew up on the edge of the Lancashire Moors with five sisters, one brother, and a vicious dog called Brock, an unwise ninth birthday present. After a school education conducted almost entirely by nuns and a series of London jobs, she married, had three children, and went to the University of Glasgow to read history and philosophy, graduating in 1997. A controversial piece in The Spectator launched her journalistic career, and she began to write regular weekly columns for, at various times, The Herald, The Scotsman, Scotland on Sunday, The Times, The Sunday Times, and The Scottish Daily Mail. She still writes columns and also contributes regularly to radio and television. She's also set up an academic writing skills website for the University of Glasgow and subsequently became that university's Royal Literary Fund Fellow. Her debut book, Blood Red Horse, a historical novel for children and the first of the de Granville trilogy, was published by Puffin UK in 2004 and Walker Books in the US in 2005. Six more children and young adult books followed, including How the Hangman Lost His Heart and The Perfect Fire trilogy. Her first novel for adults, Sedition, is a Virago book in the UK and a Henry Holt book in the US. She lives in Glasgow with her husband. Katie, you started out as a journalist, so how did you come to become a novelist?
I had an idea in the bath. But before that, I had been to a lecture by Giles Gordon, the literary agent, much lamented literary agent, on why journalists should never try and become novelists. And I don't know why, but I don't think that particularly triggered something in my brain. But at university, I had read a poem by the Norman chronicler Ambroise, and it had a line or two about horses in the Third Crusade. And it stuck with me. And one night in the bath, I had this idea for a book, and I got out and actually started to write it. And I sent a bit off to Giles Gordon, who sent back some very helpful remarks. And then shortly afterwards, I wrote the whole book. He sold it to Puffin, and suddenly I was a novelist. So I'm afraid no kind of 50 million rejection slips. It was just very smooth and almost, well, it was delightful. Not a very typical experience, I think.
Was there a particular moment when you felt it was really starting to become real for you?
Nine novels later, I don't know that that moment has ever actually arrived. I still think there's a lot of luck involved, and I still wake up in the morning surprised to find myself a novelist.
You come from a large and, by the sound of it, rather lively family. Has storytelling always been a part of your life?
Yes, possibly not in the way that most people think of it. I think storytelling in a large family, some of it is to do with it wasn't my fault, it was hers, particularly when you've got a lot of sisters. And sometimes it's storytelling between you all to try and convince your parents that, in fact, you weren't doing what you weren't supposed to be doing. So there was a lot of storytelling. We were brought up in a very Victorian way by nannies. And we told stories to our nannies. The nannies we didn't like, we told stories about ghosts and about terrible things. We'd all read The Canterville Ghost by Oscar Wilde, and we thought it was rather neat to tell the nanny that there was blood all over the larder and that whenever you try to scrub it away, it just returned the next day. And we did manage to get rid of a fair few like that, but not usually the ones we disliked the most. No, we had some lovely nannies too, and some of our lovely nannies used to tell us stories. But stories were a big part of it, and family stories. We come from a very old family with a lot of family history. So yes, stories in one way or another, in lots of different forms, played a big part in our lives.
Do you think of yourself as a genre writer?
No, I don't. I definitely think of myself as a storyteller. But I don't think of myself as a genre writer. I was surprised to find that I was a children's writer. I was then surprised to find that I was a young adult writer. I wasn't so surprised in my latest book to find that I was an adult writer, because that's what I think I had always intended to be. I don't really think of myself as a historical novelist although perhaps that's how I would be labelled in a shop.
It does seem sometimes that the publishers are the people that are particularly keen on these labels, so perhaps those labels have less meaning for the writers themselves, as you're saying.
Well, they do, but they're irritating too, because a writer then thinks, but that's blocking off a whole section of people who might actually enjoy these books. Particularly, funnily enough, with historical novels, which do tend to be ageless, if you know what I mean. I mean, I enjoy Rosemary Sutcliffe just as much now as I did when I was 12. So I think particularly for historical novelists, it's sometimes annoying to be plonked into a certain age group.
Did you consciously intend that your current novel be for adults?
Yes.
Yes, and did you have to persuade the publisher of that?
Not the publisher, but I had to not persuade my agent, but my agent was not expecting an adult novel. She was expecting another novel for children. That's why I thought that possibly she would say, oh no, that's not what you are. You're not an adult novelist, you're a children's novelist. So it was more than delightful when the answer came, yes, I'll definitely take this. I feel pleased to have sort of expanded my genre, if you see what I mean, rather than just moved into a different one.
Much of your fiction has been historical to date. How important is it to you that your historical fiction should be historically accurate?
Accuracy is important up to a point. For example, I've got to decide quite soon whether I'm going to call trousers in 1794. Now, to me, they were trousers because the French Revolution had come and there were trousers in France, but they didn't actually come to London until the early 1800s. Now, is it accurate then to call them trousers, or should I be calling them breeches? That sort of thing keeps me awake hours at night. So I do like to be accurate. Sometimes it's easy to be accurate with dates and all that kind of thing. It's much less easy to be accurate with clothes and carriages and the type of horse, because of course they didn't change overnight. So we tend to think there was this and then there was that, but of course there were huge smudgy things in the middle.
Have you ever experienced a conflict, say, between historical accuracy and accessibility if you're writing for young adults?
Yes, very much, particularly for the American market, where they say, for example, they wouldn't understand the offices that the monks sang, which played such an enormous part in medieval times, and many of my novels are set in medieval times. So trying to explain without being patronising what these things are involves a certain type of skill. And yes, it is difficult. And sometimes you just have to say, I'm going to have to change the wording here because modern children simply won't understand. But usually it's possible to contextualise it so that it is pretty obvious what it is, even if they weren't familiar with the word or the phrase or the concept before.
In your novel Bell Song, there are a lot of issues that would be quite familiar to a modern young adult audience. For example, obsessive compulsive behaviours, self-harming, concealed homosexuality. Did those themes emerge organically as the story developed, or were you actually wanting them to be part of the infrastructure of the novel?
No, they simply emerged with the character, Belle. She's the cause of a terrible accident because she's not paying attention, which causes her father to be paralysed in his legs. And she becomes obsessive compulsive after that, pretty much. I mean, she then self-harms because she feels so terribly guilty. So I hope that it reads as if it was organic, because that's exactly how it was. The book is set around Chaucer's tales, and if you read some of the tales, and you read particularly the bits about the squire, you can see that there are hidden things in there, and why shouldn't homosexuality be one of them? But I hope that the tale itself, which is basically a tale of adventure, is more pressing than the actual issues. I would hate to write an issues-based book. I think there is a place for issues-based books, but I don't think I write them.
I mean, on that theme, do you feel that authors writing for teens or young adults have any different responsibilities than authors writing for adults?
No, I think you have a responsibility to tell the truth as far as your book is able. But I don't think we have a particular responsibility to tell children all will be well, or young teenagers you should live in a certain way. I think for young adults, it's quite useful to have characters who slightly mirror their own concerns. And after all, that's your readership, so you're bound to think in that kind of a way. And some things are going to end well and some things aren't going to end well. There's an awful pull in your mind as to whether everything should have a happy ending. I think my endings are reasonably realistic in that everything doesn't always turn out okay. Some things do and some things don't. And I think that's sort of like life. But I don't feel that's my responsibility, because once the story takes over, then you hope that that's what drives it along, rather than any kind of outside pressure.
In your researches for that novel, did you come across any historical accounts of what might have been OCD or self-harming behaviour?
Some of the medieval saints, the ones who dedicated themselves to God in a reasonably manic way, were certainly anorexic. Some were certainly delusional. Some certainly suffered from OCD, the obsessive praying. I mean, St. Simon Stylite, who lived on a pillar. I mean, that seems a bit OCD to me. I mean, you live on a pillar. Everything's very controlled up there. I'm sure you don't have to worry about much apart from staying on your pillar. The medieval saints, I think, were full of very competitive praying, competitive Christianity. So I think there is a fair amount of stuff in there, which I think probably does feed into OCD and all sorts of other diseases which we now give names to, which they just thought of as being either weird or tremendously saintly, one or the other.
It must be wonderful to capture those resonances when you're writing for teenagers, as if to say, look, these things that you're going through have been gone through by people throughout time. Perhaps they experienced it in a different way or described their experiences in a different conceptual framework. But, you know, that experience is there.
Well, I think that's one of the wonderful things about being a historical novelist is discovering that so many things are just the same. Some things are massively different. And I think that we shouldn't underestimate or underplay the fact that in the medieval times, the worldview was completely different. They simply didn't think like we do. It wasn't just a question of us being able to go onto mobile phones and move a bit quicker. God was a huge part, and God was a sort of living, lowering presence for some people. But on the other hand, there is continuity. Yes, they may not have been called teenagers in the Middle Ages, but nevertheless, they were 13, 14, 15. And I don't think that we in our hormonal and physical development are all that different from what people were like then. So I'm sure they went through the same things. I often wonder, though, if a teenager now meeting a teenager from, let's say, the 1230s, what they would have in common, whether they would even like each other, whether they would be so far apart that they would simply dislike each other, or whether character would come through and so they might or might not like each other, just as we like or like don't like people now.
Have you felt that you've wanted to bring out that very different worldview in your stories, or are you more oriented around the story itself, telling the story in a contemporary voice in a way that contemporary audiences will appreciate?
No, I think I don't do that. I think I try and look at the world from my character's point of view. For example, in the de Granville trilogy with Blood Red Horse, the girl, Ellie, marries the person who she is designed to marry and not the person she wants to marry. And she makes no objection because she understands that that is how it is. And some readers have said, oh, but we wanted Ellie to marry Will. And you say, well, she doesn't marry Will because she is always destined to marry Gavin, and that's what she does because she's a dutiful girl. It doesn't mean to say that she's got no character or that she's a doormat, but she knows her duty and she does it. And that, I think, is a strength of character and not a weakness. I like a good feisty heroine, but a good feisty heroine doesn't have to always be rebelling against her parents or her duty. She can be perfectly feisty in lots of other ways.
Have you ever written a heroine that you didn't like very much?
No. I wonder whether you probably could. There are certainly some girls in my adult novel, some that I like better than others, but I've never written a heroine that I really dislike. I think that would be a great challenge. Perhaps that's what I'll do next, write a heroine who I don't actually like. But you always end up having some kind of sympathy with them because you're so in with them that you can see why they do things, even if they do some horrible things. But that would be a good challenge. Yes.
Do you feel that your experience as a journalist has helped or hindered you in writing historical fiction in particular?
I think it helps with writing in general, even though they're two completely different beasts. But the journalism teaches you about the power of adrenaline, you know, get it down, get it done, and keeps you up to the mark time-wise. The thing it could teach you is about researching and about speedy researching. But actually, speedy researching is not what you do for a historical novel. You end up reading piles of books which you never actually use anything from them, apart from they give you a feel. For example, for Sedition, I read a lot about the development of the piano. Well, no reader of a novel is going to want endless screeds about the development of the physical piano. But to me, it was very useful because I needed to be able to hear what this new fangled instrument actually sounded like. I think it teaches you to try and get straight to the bit that you need. But sometimes writing a novel, that's not so helpful. Whereas writing journalism, you need to get to the bit that you need because you simply haven't time to start faffing around with all the other bits. It's very nice writing a novel. When you're writing journalism, you do your research, you use the stuff, but by and large, it's quickly in and quickly out. With a novel, you do much more absorbing of stuff. So when I'm researching for journalistic pieces, I have to remember, Katie, you're not writing a novel. You've only got 20 minutes, so don't get hooked up on learning about, you know, what hangmen were paid in 1746. You know, you're not supposed to be looking about that. You're supposed to be reading about the electric chair in America today.
So have you always had an interest in history?
Yes. I think it would be impossible to be brought up in a family like mine who've lived in more or less the same place for nearly 1,000 years and not be interested in history. We were brought up on history. We were brought up to feel that the past was probably better than the present, and certainly the people were more heroic, because my family were recusant Catholics, because we're rather bloody-minded. Lord Burghley once described my family as of more than usual perversity. Lord Burghley being the treasurer to Elizabeth I. So we refused to become Protestants during the Reformation, and some of my family were killed as a result of that. So I think we were always taught that the people of the past had done this great thing. They'd stood up for what they believed in. And that was both a curse and a blessing. It was a blessing because you thought, my goodness me, I've got something to sort of live up to here. But it was a curse because the past also traps you. You feel, well, how can I stop being a Catholic when my family died for this? And that isn't a great feeling. So it stops you in some ways from progressing in a sort of natural way of throwing things off, because your whole family history has been about keeping things going and keeping things together. But whenever I've started a novel, it's always ended up being set in the past. So I must in some way be affected by history. It is in me, I suppose. I'm more naturally drawn to that than I am to contemporary fiction. I don't know whether I'd be any good at writing contemporary fiction at all.
Do you have a favourite era of the eras that you've written about?
I used to think it was the medieval era, but I am actually become passionately involved in the era that I'm writing about. So the 1790s, which is what I've most recently written about, I knew very little about the 1790s before I started to write. I wanted to write this book because I was very interested in the change between the harpsichord and the piano, how revolution loosens things in everything, art, poetry, music, people's behaviour, people's clothes, and the turn of centuries is very interesting to me. So my adult novel is set in 1794, a very particular time of revolution and change, when in Britain we still didn't know if the French Revolution was going to come here and there would be turmoil here. The terror was going on in Paris. So I now love that. I love that period. But when I was writing about the Third Crusade, I loved the 1190s. And when I was writing about the Cathars, I loved the 1200s. So you do become very sort of obsessive. But actually, by the end of writing about the medieval period, I longed for a bit of gunpowder and a good gun. Swords are done. I was finished with swords. I wanted a gun.
Writing about these very dramatic periods in history, has that changed your sense of the dramas of the day, if you like?
It has, in quite an unexpected way, because amid the great dramas which we all know about, ordinary life just coursed along. If you read Amanda Foreman's Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, you find that in the very year of the French Revolution, of the fall of the Bastille, Georgiana goes off to Paris, she goes to the opera, and you tend to think, but the opera can't have been operating, because, I mean, weren't they having a revolution? But, of course, we call it a revolution now. At the time, I suppose it just seemed like things that were ongoing during the day. And, of course, it then escalated, that particular event. But underneath all these things, people were born, they were worried about children's sickness, they were worried about their children's schooling. So ordinary life went on to a great extent. And that's what I've been really interested in looking at, and that's why my 1794 novel is not about great events. It's set in the time of the French Revolution. It has nothing to do with the French Revolution. These are just city speculators living in London, doing the best for their children. So I think that when you write, you tend to pick times of turmoil because they're interesting times, but underneath you find that there's ordinary life going on. I love that idea, because that's what's happening to us too. When people look back on our era, they'll say, oh my goodness, look at all the things that happened in the 1990s and the 2000s. But to me, it's when my children were born and growing up, and those are my primary memories, not the great big things that were going on in the world.
Has this perspective that you've gained from writing historical fiction changed the way that you write journalistic pieces, and personal columns in particular?
Yes, I think it has. I think I'm more objective now, I hope. Also, I've had the benefit of some great editors and great editors of novels help you with your journalistic writing, because they, unlike editors in newspapers who haven't really got time to say we hate that or don't do that, good editors with a good eye will pick out your quirks, some of which are useful in journalistic writing because your column needs to look as if it's by you and not by somebody else. But on the other hand, being well edited in a novel is fantastically helpful for your writing in general. So I think that has fed through in lots of very positive ways into my journalistic writing.
And is it true that all journalists are really closet novelists that just haven't met it yet?
Oh dear, that would be awful, wouldn't it? No, I think some people are born journalists and they write fabulous journalism, but their books are less successful because they still bring the same kind of eye to their books as they do to their journalism. Perhaps that's because people have just suggested they wrote a book and they didn't really have the drive to write the book. I certainly hope that that's not the case with me, because I really did have a drive to write the book. And becoming a journalist was also a slightly unexpected thing. I didn't go to journalism school or train to be a journalist. I just tried to get a piece into a newspaper and I got the piece in and it caused a small controversy. And the following week I had a column. That was how it happened. So I am one of these lucky people to whom nice things have happened and, you know, I've been in the right place at the right time. So my two writing strands, the journalism and the books, seem disconnected in some way from each other. I'm not a journalist who's become an author. I think I'm a sort of, crikey, now I'm writing columns, and now, crikey, now I'm writing novels. And that's how it really has been for me.
You've written a lot for young adult audiences. Do you feel that there's extra pressure on you in that role to be engaged with your readership through social media?
Oh, I do, and goodness me, do I hate it. I'm not a social media person. I don't particularly have endless things I want to say, and I don't know why readers need to know what I had for breakfast. Perhaps it's because I'm a journalist that I think opinions on current events belong to my journalism. I don't think they particularly belong to my novel writing. And although I talk a lot, I actually don't want to expose my every thought every day. I don't have things that are worth saying every day. And I don't want to have instant reactions, because usually my instant reactions are completely wrong. So I usually want to change them. And once you're out there on social media, you can't change it. It's there. I have run a blog. I ran a blog about my year of playing the piano, because my girls in Sedition, they have to learn the Goldberg variations. And I thought it would be good if I learnt them as well, along with my girls in my novel.
Method writing, if you like.
Method writing, exactly. So that's what I did, and I kept a blog about that. But I think blogging is a genre on its own, and I think you either love it or it's a struggle. And I think if it's a struggle, it can become a daily struggle. So it's like a daily burden, which I don't really want.
Do young readers get in touch with you?
They do. Not in vast numbers, but they do. And I always answer. And I do have a website. And I think that that's a nice thing to do. When I was young, I thought all writers were dead. I didn't realise that they actually were still alive. And my son wrote to Muriel Spark about 6 months before she died about a passage in Jean Brodie, which he didn't understand. And she wrote back. And I think if Muriel Spark can do it, so can I. So I do respond. And responding to readers is nice, because they usually ask certain questions and you engage in a proper conversation.
There's a lot of talk about young people not reading anymore. What do you think?
I think young people don't read with so much attention anymore. I think that's the real bother. I think young people do read, but they've got to somehow feel that what they're reading has already been prejudged as good. So they usually want to read what the others are reading. So it is true that they don't read so much. I'd spend almost no time worrying about that, because it would be completely pointless. I would think it was a pity if it completely died out, which I think it never will. People like to be transported to a different world, and a book is the quickest and easiest way to remove yourself from the world that you're in. It takes a second, doesn't it? You open the covers and there you are. And that, to me, is never going to lose its appeal.
I sometimes wonder if the immersion of a book will become part of its charm, because our attention is so fragmented in so many other spheres that having a device that doesn't actually interrupt you might become yet more appealing.
And also children, luckily, become adults. So in the end, they are going to want that space from what they think now is, I want to be connected all the time, I want this machine and that machine, and I can't do anything without my music plugged in and all the rest of it. But by the time they're grown up, I think you're right, I think there will be a stepping back saying, what we really value now is silence. Because we never have it. And a book is about the most silent form of entertainment that you can have. And you do sometimes see on the tube, you see young people sitting in silence. Okay, they've usually got something plugged into their ears. But I wonder how much they're hearing and whether the book is all absorbing. One of the nicest sights in the whole world, I think, is seeing people leap up and say, oh God, I've missed my stop, because they've been reading.
Having learned the piano as a child, you've come back to it now in the writing of your current book. What's that experience been like?
It's been absolutely marvellous, dementing often, but marvellous. I learnt the piano, yes, as a child, and then didn't play when I worked in London and all the rest of it. In the year 2000, as our millennium present to ourselves, we bought the most expensive thing we've ever bought. We bought a Yamaha, sort of 6'6" grand, which we have here. I could live without the telly, but I wouldn't like to live without the piano. Going back to the piano was not like greeting an old friend. It was more like greeting an old enemy in some ways, because you're not going to be any better if you haven't played for ages. But I'm quite a disciplined person. So once I started to say to myself, I am going to practice every day, that's what I did. And although for weeks you think I'm not getting any better, you do get better. It's like running like that. In order to run, you have to run. So I did play, and little by little you do improve. But I have a phobia of playing when anybody can hear me. It doesn't matter if it's people in the street who couldn't know who it was, or the neighbours or anybody. And I have found that very, very hard to conquer. So we have a silencer on our piano so I can play without annoying people or frightening myself. But that's been very good in some ways, because if you have a silencer so you're not worried about the neighbours or other people, you can really, really practice. You can practice for hours the same phrase because you're not annoying anybody. And that is the only way to get any better. An hour or two on the piano and you feel tired, physically tired. And that has been important because I'm a terrible insomniac. And the silencer is very good in that respect, because you can come down in the middle of the night and play it and all you can hear is clack, clack, clack. It's my favourite part of the day, even though, just like writing, sometimes you really don't want to do it. You have an inbuilt resistance. Oh, surely I better hang out the washing, better do the hoovering, anything than sit down and practice. But I make myself do it. And after about 10 minutes, you think, oh, I don't want to get up now. I'm hooked in here.
Do you think that's the reason you've managed to be such a productive novelist? That grit, that determination to steel yourself and sit down and do it?
I think it probably is, and I don't know where that comes from. I think that's probably genetic. I've always been very conscious of time, partly because I went to university when my children were born. I went as a mature student, so most of my work was done in the middle of the night, quite time pressured. And you always thought, I must get this essay finished, because otherwise one of the children will get chicken pox, the other one will get measles, and then I'll never get it done. And so time has always been very precious to me. So I am quite good. I mean, I procrastinate just like everyone else. But when I'm productive, I am pretty productive.
Animals seem to have played a very big part in both your life and your fiction. So could you tell us some more about some of those animals?
Yeah. I've always had animals. My first present was on my 9th birthday. And my parents were never very good at remembering birthdays. And so I went down and I saw that on the breakfast table, I thought, oh, they've obviously forgotten. But there was a little card and it just said, I am Brock. Please come and fetch me. And they bought me a dog. And Brock, he was a demon. He was a Jack Russell Terrier and he bit and fought and took on anything. He was my first dog. He was an absolute nightmare and I doted on him. So he survived until he was about 10, when he'd bitten so many people that it really was just not on anymore. And horses played a big part. We were the beneficiary of ponies, often that other people didn't want or couldn't house, and so they came to live with us. So we were very lucky. We had some ponies, most of whom were incredibly badly behaved and bucked us off all the time. And then we migrated upwards to horses. So we've always had animals who've been slightly troublesome, I suppose. They've put us into hospital many, many times. But my favourite, I mean, I had a lovely, lovely, lovely horse called Miss Muffet, a chestnut mare, and she was absolutely the model for Hosanna in Blood Red Horse. She was one of those horses where you'll never have another one like her. So there were those sort of domesticated animals, and then the house was full of mice and I don't know what. And we had gerbils, and we let the gerbils out one school holidays, and they all escaped, and they never came back to the cage, which we thought they would. And I think they must have mated with the mice. And then the house was overrun by these peculiar creatures. So livestock have played a part, yes, in our lives.
What do you think is the best bit of advice you'd have for aspiring young writers in your audience?
Read. I think that is absolutely the key. If you don't read, you can't write. And some people don't really have a book in them, because a book requires a leap in the dark, which is more than just thinking, oh, I can write nice sentences. I know it's a cliche to say it's a lonely path, but it is a pretty lonely path. But the thing that's going to help you most is reading, because reading will either inspire you, or you'll quite usefully think, I can't do that. And you'll never learn anything about yourself as a writer if you don't read. You need to read genres which you don't think you like. You need to read books which you don't like. You need to notice things in other people's books, how they've done things. So if you want to be a good writer, you need to be a good reader.
And what bit of advice would you have for yourself now? What would your best piece of advice be?
The best is the enemy of the good, I think. You can go endlessly, endlessly over things, but books aren't perfect, and some of their imperfections are what makes them nice to read. I'm a tremendous rewriter. I'm not one of these people who just writes things and it's over. Not at all. I rewrite endlessly, sometimes to not very good effect, I think. So my own advice to myself would be to accept your limitations. Stretch them as far as they will go, but there is a point beyond which you can't go, and you're probably not even the best judge of where that point is.
And finally, what does a good day look like to you?
A good day is always a day when I've achieved something which has been hard. A bad day would be a day when I didn't practice a piano. It's not that I'm good, it's just that that's the way I know I've done something positive in a day. I don't run. I hate every form of exercise apart from walking and riding horses, which I obviously don't do in Glasgow. So I need to feel that something that I've done, that it's going to accumulate. It might not even have been a very good practice, but it would have been something that I feel is of benefit. So I would certainly have done some writing, whether of journalism or a book, or I might have just lain in the sun with a good book, come in and done half an hour's practice, had a drink and gone to bed.
Katie Grant, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
That was Katie Grant in conversation with Cona McPhee. You can find out more about Katie on her website at www.katherinegrant.com. That's Katherine with two A's. And that concludes episode 9, which was recorded and produced by Cona McPhee. Coming up in episode 10, we have writers Gwyneth Lewis and Joanne Limburg speaking with Julia Kopis about mental illness and its effects on their writing lives. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.